This year's elections in New York saw record levels of participation by mail as a result of relaxed state laws governing the excuses for voting absentee. And while there is a perception that this type of voting is ripe for fraud and abuse, it is actually a highly scrutinized process, with the ballots and their envelopes not only subject to review by the local boards of elections, but they can also be thoroughly interrogated by private attorneys who may be hired by candidates when races are being decided by a very narrow margin. The final layer of scrutiny, of private attorneys raising objections, can be controversial, though, prompting allegations of voter disenfranchisement. To explain this process, including how it's being utilized in contested state Senate races this year, we're speaking with Perry Grossman, senior staff attorney in the Voting Rights Project at the New York Civil Liberties Union, a nonpartisan organization. So, from your experience, when do candidates typically utilize attorneys in the absentee ballot counting process, and what can that involvement consist of?
So, this is an unprecedented level of attorney involvement in the absentee ballot counting process. New York's election law is pretty Byzantine, and it incentivizes the filing of these preemptive lawsuits. So, lawsuits are filed before the election even occurs to count ballots that haven't even been cast yet. So, what happens here is attorneys for some of the candidates filed petitions all over the state, demanding tons and tons of records, access to all the absentee ballots and their scans and the registration records and all that. What happens next is, obviously the in-person votes are cast on election night. They're all tallied up, from the optical scanners. Over the next week, the boards of elections review all the absentee and affidavit ballots and other paper ballots that have come in. They check them against the registration records. They make sure the signatures match. They look at any other information that might be provided and make sure that they're presumptively okay. If they have curable defects, voters are sent notices and given an opportunity to cure those defects, right? Maybe their signature is missing. But most of the ballots are fine. So all of those paper ballots are reviewed by bipartisan teams at the Board of Elections, Democrat and a Republican. Both look at them. If there's a defect, voters get notice. If there isn't, they are put into the post-election canvas. And what happens is at the Board of Elections, the Board of Elections will set up a number of tables at which there are commissioners and poll inspectors and election administrators of both parties. And then representatives of the candidates will be there. And, plenty of ballots are just reviewed. They are opened. Eventually, they are fed through the scanner and counted. But this year, we are seeing representatives of the parties, and one party in particular, challenge lots and lots of mail-in ballots. And that is really delaying the canvassing process by a lot. In the first instance, a lot of these lawsuits demanded that the canvasses be delayed by a week or more in some places. And that's really pushed everything back. And then once you get into the room, each of these challenges is causing the process to take even longer. So I think a lot of races that are still counting or were counting last week could have been done easily a week earlier. And that delay is just inexcusable. In fact, the challenge process as a whole is really just in many ways an inexcusable effort to disenfranchise perfectly qualified voters who really complied with the law in submitting their affidavit or absentee ballots.
Well, what are the challenges that attorneys will bring even after these ballots and their envelopes have been scrutinized by the local boards of elections?
It's a good question. We're seeing a lot of really ridiculous challenges. The first one, I think the most ridiculous that I've seen is there are challenges to the absentee ballots of voters who submitted their absentee ballot applications over internet portals or by email without putting a wedding signature on an absentee ballot. And if you did that, if you submitted your absentee ballot application that way, that is absolutely fine because the law was changed precisely to allow you to do that. So this is a challenge that is flatly contradictory to the election law. There is certainly no constitutional requirement that says you have to sign your absentee ballot application. The only requirement is that your signature at the polls or your signature on an absentee ballot needs to sufficiently correspond to your registration record. It certainly does not need to be a perfect match, and it never is. So the challenges to the applications without signatures, I find to be frivolous and really just a naked attempt to roll the dice in court with ballots that are absolutely fine. The another one that I think is on that level is there are challenges to the ballots of voters who hand-delivered their ballots to the polls on Election Day. And, you, of course, you can deliver your ballot to the poll on Election Day. The polls do not close until 9 p.m., and there's a lot to do when the polls are closing up. And so a lot of those, in fact, maybe all of them, were not time-stamped by the Board of Elections until the next day. That's fine. The law says all you have to do is hand-deliver your ballot to the polls before the close of polls on Election Day. It says nothing about time-stamping. But candidates have been challenging ballots that were time-stamped the next day, even if they were delivered on time. Nothing in the election law says anything about the time-stamping of a ballot that's hand-delivered. So, again, that's another sort of wild swing trying to knock ballots out of the canvas in order to give, you know, I don't know if it's a better optical shot or whatever, to candidates who happen to be leading in the polls after in-person voting on Election Day. Obviously, the winner of a race is not who's leading the polls when only the in-person votes are counted. The winner of a race is the person who's leading after all the ballots are counted. So in some sense, I really see a lot of these challenges as of a kind with the national strategy to delay the count, to throw whatever at the wall to see what sticks, to just try and disenfranchise as many voters as possible. You know, there are other more conventional challenges, which I still, frankly, feel are pretty offensive. You know, we have Democrats and Republicans at the Board of Elections, professional election administrators, reviewing voters' signatures and matching them. Challenging signatures that have already been validated. Again, this is just another wild swing to try and disenfranchise voters. And putting a ballot in front of, you know, one partisan judge after it's already been reviewed by a bipartisan team, you know, seems like a pretty unfair process and one that shouldn't end up disenfranchising a lot of voters, but it certainly delays things out more. And so that's another one. You know, there's easily five or six categories of challenges that are ridiculous, certainly to the affidavit ballots. You know, I've seen challenges to affidavit ballots, which are, you know, they get filed by voters whose names aren't in the poll records. And this year, because we've had a change in the law, a really good change in the law, that says that if you are already a registered voter in New York State and you move to another address, another county, your registration follows you. You don't have to re-register. And so, you know, voters who might have moved without re-registering were able to go in and cast an affidavit ballot and have that counted and have their registration updated with that. But, you know, we've seen a lot of objections to really trivial issues. You know, somebody wrote, you know, there's a line for the county you live in, and maybe somebody wrote the city and zip code. Obviously, if you have the city and zip code, you can tell what county that person lives in. But, you know, just little things all over the place, just really naked attempts to try and throw out the ballots of people who the Board of Elections has already identified and verified as eligible voters, which is all the law requires. In fact, there was an express change to the law made to make sure that voters' ballots would be counted as long as they substantially complied with the law. And that substantial compliance means if the Board of Elections can figure out that, you know, you're an eligible voter and this is your ballot, then you're good to go.
You sort of hinted at this with your reference in passing to a partisan judge considering these objections, but can you explain sort of the next step? Because initially, you know, when someone does object to a ballot, it's not like they are immediately thrown into the shredder. What happens with those objections? What are some of the different outcomes that can be eventually reached with regards to these ballots that are being contested?
In most cases, you know, the candidate has preemptively filed a lawsuit in the county of their choice. So take, for example, the 46th Senate district where Michelle Hinchey just declared victory. That district runs from Ulster County all the way up to Montgomery County. It's a pretty big swatch. It covers a lot of different counties. the Republican candidate for office there filed a preemptive lawsuit up in Montgomery County at the sort of the far northern reaches. And so what will happen is even in Ulster County, where there are challenges to the ballots being made, those challenged ballots will be pulled aside. They will not be counted. And the Republicans and the Democrats, who have made a couple of objections to, will eventually decide which ballots they want to put in front of the judge. Now, if the margin of victory is so enormous that the challenged ballots won't matter, maybe they hold off. But in a close race, you know, they'll decide which ballots that the Board of Elections has already said are fine should be put back in front of a judge with all of their ridiculous objection. But it's unseemly. And not only is it unseemly, you know, you're taking the votes of, you know, qualified electors in Ulster County, and you're dragging their votes up into court, you know, 90 minutes, 2 hours away, depending on where they live and what the traffic's like. So that seems to me to be a pretty unfair process. You know, not only is it ridiculous that anyone should have sort of a second bite at the apple at disenfranchising these voters, but then to try and do it in such a way that it's not fully transparent to the voters, that they're not able to come in and easily defend their ballots, that they've got to go so far out of their way, if they're able to figure it out at all, you know, is really deeply inequitable.
When considering these objections, do judges typically err on the side of counting votes and giving voters the benefit of the doubt for maybe small technical mistakes or things that aren't even mistakes at all, but the attorneys might raise concerns about?
So in general, you know, when I review these cases, I do tend to see judges giving deference to the boards of elections, but I also see cases in which the judges sort of, you know, take their own, you know, first instance kind of look at signatures and things like that, which they shouldn't be doing. You know, they don't have any particular qualification in handwriting expertise. Their single set of eyes is not better than the bipartisan teams that have reviewed this. You know, frankly, an equitable process would say that the votes that have been reviewed by a bipartisan team and are going to be counted should be counted. And the only people who should have recourse to challenge the decisions of the Board of Elections are voters who are being disenfranchised and want to make sure their ballots are getting counted. The idea that we have this second process where attorneys can, again, just throw whatever at the wall to see what sticks to try and knock out the ballots of New York voters is deeply anti-democratic.
You've kind of hinted at this throughout the interview, but you mentioned early on how the attorneys will request records with regards to the absentees, and it's sort of their way to go digging into the voters themselves. What are they looking for when determining what objections to make? I mean, is it as simple as this person is a Republican and I'm the attorney for the Democrat, let's find a way to object to this person and vice versa?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty fair assessment. It really is largely based on how do we knock out as many people who are not likely to vote for our candidate as possible? How do we, you know, really, really reach to just, you know, take any chance we can to try and make the margin a little bit closer? There are, in the course of, you know, the canvas, a few ballots. I mean, we're talking about the number of ballots you can count on your fingers and toes, which probably should not have been canvassed in the first place. You know, ballots where they're wide open, there may be deliberate markings on the ballot, which is, you know, contrary to state law, things like that. But overwhelmingly, I'd say well over 90% of the ballots that I've seen are just dart throws, blind dart throws to try and get as many, if, you know, if you're a Republican, you're trying to knock out anyone who's not voting on the Republican, conservative, or independence line. And, you know, for the Democrats who are maybe making some of these sort of mirror challenges to, in this kind of world of mutually assured destruction, their challenge is heavily run towards people who vote on, who are enrolled in the Republican, conservative, or independence parties. So it really is very much a a partisan-based system that's just trying to reduce the number of votes that have been cast.
And I think an example that really underscores that is in the 50th Senate District, which has counting on hold right now due to a COVID-19 outbreak. And there, Republican Angie Renna was leading on election night. And one of her campaign attorneys, Bob Farley, gained a little bit of internet notoriety because of some of his actions during the counting process, which I think underscores what we were talking about. Can you explain what he is filmed doing?
So if you... If you're watching the video, and I believe it's on the website of the Syracuse paper there, which
exactly
does fine election coverage, and I recommend it highly. You know, you'll see a table, a typical table at a paper ballot canvas, and sitting around that table will be inspectors from both parties, and you know, frankly, they're kind of having a good time because it's a really boring process, and if you're not sitting there keeping each other in a good mood, things can get sour. So just as a quick note, I want to make sure that we give credit to the election officials who really are putting in a lot of hard work right now to count a ton of paper ballots. So anyway, they're sitting around and they notice the ballot of a voter who has apparently written something noting that he will be voting for Trump, not on the ballot, which would spoil the ballot, but likely on the envelope somewhere, which would not spoil the ballot. And they're chuckling. And Mr. Farley comes over, tells the poll inspector to put the ballot back in the box because they're objecting to it. When the poll inspector, who raises, well, he's telling you that he's probably voting for Trump, so are you sure you want to object to it? Mr. Farley all of a sudden reverses and decides not to object to the ballot.
I'm assuming he's telling you that he's voting for Trump. So, but you want to object to it?
And then I think really takes an unnecessary pot shot at the inspectors for having some levity at the table. So, you know, if you have an objection that would be valid, it should be valid for people of any partisan affiliation. If you're making an objection and it's only because the person you think is likely to vote against you, that's a bad faith objection. That is a bad faith challenge. And frankly, we should all be looking closely at what that means from an attorney ethics standpoint, as well as from really fundamentally changing, if not altogether dismantling, the challenge process. Because that particular video, which again, so much credit to the person who took it, really captures in a nutshell everything that is problematic about the challenge process. It really is just a wild swing at trying to disenfranchise the voters that you think are not likely to vote for your candidate based on whatever information is available to you, which is mostly the voter's choice of partisan affiliation and their registration. But, you know, in this particular instance, by fortuitous, undisqualifying marks on the ballot suggesting that he's voting for a particular candidate.
You use the expression bad faith objections. Is there any sort of repercussion for an attorney if it's deemed that they are making, in fact, bad faith objections?
You know, there really haven't been in the past, but there, of course, there should be. There is a canon of legal ethics that applies to lawyers all the time. And we have, unfortunately, a statutory process that doesn't contain any disincentives from making frivolous challenges. But of course, an attorney needs to be held to the standard of discipline that the code of ethics requires. And so, you know, there's been a substantial amount of discussion about whether and to what extent the attorneys have been making these bad faith challenges should be subjected to discipline. Because really, like I said, this is very much of a kind. This is just bad faith efforts at disenfranchisement and bad faith efforts at delay and altering public opinion by pushing back the canvas process to try and give an undeserved air of victory to candidates who received more votes on election night. And that's not okay. And, you know, thankfully, in the rest of the country, we have seen judges overwhelmingly reject the wild swings that are taken in court by lawyers, mostly for the president or for allied groups, at trying to do things like overturn certifications and throw out the ballots of qualified voters. And, you know, this is really just a small-scale version of the same thing. And we should be really looking closely at what we do about attorneys who are willing to really shortchange legal ethics in service of that bad faith goal.
So in addition to considering potential repercussions for bad faith objections, is there anything else to this process that state lawmakers should consider overhauling when they return for a legislative session in 2021?
Sure. I mean, I think there's a lot of changes that we've learned the election law needs after the stress test of this year. As I mentioned before, I really think the challenge process needs to fundamentally just go. It really has no business in the law. We let professional election administrators review these ballots. We have provisions in the law to make sure that the ballots of eligible voters whose identities can be verified get counted. And, you know, we have a procedure in the law that would allow for voters to make sure that their ballots get counted if they get disqualified wrongly by the boards of elections. But there should be no opportunity on the back end for candidates to simply get a second bite at the apple at looking at every single absentee or affidavit or other paper ballot. It fundamentally undermines a democracy, and it slows everything down. It is a phenomenal waste of taxpayer resources. I can't tell you, there's a lot of people sitting around those tables watching these ballots get counted, and these challenges are delaying things by days and sometimes weeks. And this year in particular, they have exposed people to awful public health consequences, right? The Onondaga County Board of Elections is not going to resume counting until November 30th because COVID has run through some of the employees there. I believe the Sullivan County Board of Elections is also experiencing a shutdown due to COVID. You know, we should be doing less of this, not more of this. And so I think there really is so much to look at, and doing away with the challenge process, I think, would be beneficial for everybody.
We've been speaking with Perry Grossman. He is a senior staff attorney in the Voting Rights Project at the New York Civil Liberties Union. Perry, thank you so much for making the time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for covering the issue, David. Really appreciate it.
Support for the Capitol Press Room is provided by New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals in education, human services, and healthcare.